The Metal AI Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Medical AI Podcast, a 30-minute thrill ride of big ideas. We are Dr. Felix Beecher and Joe McKeating, and we talk to a range of top guests, from scientists to industry innovators to philosophers. One year ago, very soon after the release of ChatGPT, there was an article in Nature with a very curious title: ChatGPT listed as author on research papers. Many scientists disapprove. Since then, the use of LLMs or large language models in medical research has exploded, including as a co-author of articles. But how is it being used? Does it matter? Does it undermine the human authors? And does it risk the quality of the research? Well, with me to discuss this is a brilliant and up-and-coming researcher at the Universal Scientific Education and Research Network, Fiona Morrison. Fiona, a very, very warm welcome. I'm thrilled to have you on.
Hi, Felix. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Fiona, could you just introduce yourself?
Well, I guess, you know, my academic background is currently that I am an ambassador, a junior ambassador at the Universal Scientific Education Research Network, which is a huge international research network that started in Iran. And I'm currently the ambassador to the United Kingdom, but I'm living in Germany. And my role within this network is I'm there as a public health / global health researcher. So that's kind of what I do within the network. And I try and bring those perspectives into a network full of people who are from vastly different scientific backgrounds as I am.
Okay, now we'll get into the substance of what your recent paper was, but your recent paper, I would say, is philosophical in nature. And could you describe something about what your fundamental perspective is on ethics?
Yeah, so I mean, it was definitely a philosophical paper because we were sort of asking the question of right and wrong, I suppose, and how to use things correctly. And I would say that I'm definitely, when it comes to technological advances and stuff like that, I'm more of a deontologist. I follow Kant, really. So I really think that the intent is definitely a big thing. I think it's really important what your intent was. And I sometimes think intent is more important than consequence. Not always, but sometimes. And I definitely think that there are universal sort of moral rules of good and bad that we're all aware of, and that as researchers, we can sort of align ourselves with, which I think is what makes the paper that we wrote really interesting, because we were all, you know, we're about 10 authors and we're all really on the same page. So that kind of definitely confirmed to me that I think there are these universal rules.
Okay, it's not just because you're sitting in Germany and therefore Kant is kind of like an obligation, is it?
yeah, sort of.
All right.
True enough.
So why don't we just briefly talk about the historical perspective? Because some people might say, I think, that there's nothing fundamentally different about AI or large language models in particular, that this is just one type of technological advance like any other. Is that true? Is there something distinctive in terms of this area of philosophy about AI systems?
Well, I think you can definitely argue, as you could with any other technological advance, that it is in essence just, you know, there is a fear of the unknown. It's something new. And in that sense, it's the same as, you know, electricity, or, you know, when you start writing on paper instead of using chalkboards and stuff, there's always, you know, there's always someone who thinks that it's, you know, scary or something to be feared. And in that sense, it's the same as everything else. And I think we would do well not to over glorify AI in the sense of saying it's this absolutely completely distinct and revolutionary thing. However, it is in many aspects, you know. AI is different than any other technology in the sense that it can adapt and evolve on its own without specific programming. So it can sort of train itself and improve itself and become more intelligent over time, which, you know, philosophically poses the question in the end, sort of what makes it distinct from from us, what makes it distinct from a human author. And we're also, you know, we're in the day and age of sharing absolutely everything online immediately. So as opposed to other technologies we've had in the past, you can optimize your use almost instantly by asking people online, hey, which questions do I ask? How do I use this the best? So, you know, it's definitely distinct because of the era that it's in as well. And it's also distinct in the sense that it's completely unpredictable at this point in time. We've got the black box problem. So you don't actually really know what's going into an AI and what happens within the model when you ask it a question, which is very different from any technology that we've had before. You've usually been able to see exactly how everything works. So, yeah, I'd say AI is different in the sense that it's making us question our humanity a little bit, you know, in that sense, definitely.
I guess partly also because it's just been so sudden, right? It took people by surprise. Yeah. And also, like you say, it's a black box. Not just in a fundamental sense, which it is, but also in the sense that nearly very, very, very few people really understand at a detailed level what these large language models are and how they work, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we would say that, you know, at this point in time, it's only really the actual developers that know exactly how it works. Because, you know, within the last year, you're talking about historical perspective, within the last year, AI, large language models have moved from being this thing where all of the research and all of the steps that went into it were shared, from moving into a highly competitive economic market. So people are starting to, you know, hide their, you know, trade secrets. So really, it is only the developers who know what's going on. That is a very small handful of people.
Now, let me ask you a small question to just at this early stage. What large language LLMs do you use personally and why?
So I started off with, I think, as most people did, with the OpenAI version of ChatGPT, just sort of messing around with it a bit. But I have found that when I use it in my personal academic life, I tend to use Google Bard, which is in the better version right now. It's not completely finished. But Google Bard is my favorite because it actually uses, it can give you proper sources, which ChatGPT can't. And Google Bard is integrated into search engines far better. So it can actually search real things. So for an example, this might sound quite kitschy, but I was looking recently for wedding dresses and I could ask Google Bard exactly what I wanted and it would give me actual real links and real shops where I could find exactly what I wanted, which is something that I lack in ChatGPT. So ChatGPT, if I want something writing quickly on sort of one question, then I use that, but Google Bard is for more complex things and that's what I tend to use more.
Okay, well I hope it picks you out a nice dress. And
it did,
because otherwise you could look like, I don't know, you could look like a right state and it wouldn't be your fault, but it would still ruin the day.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Why don't we turn to your excellent paper in the Journal of Medical AI, which came out very recently. Could you just explain the gist of that paper?
Yeah, so our paper was, and I think the title says it quite well, it's about maintaining scientific integrity and high research standards against the backdrop of rising artificial intelligence use across fields. And so the paper came from a place of, you know, everyone in my team, the Universal Scientific and Education Research Network, everyone comes from a different field, really. So, you know, you have doctors, you have public health researchers, you have microbiologists, you have people who work in IT. So we all wanted to come together basically to face this problem of AI as a scientific team internationally and across fields. And so what the paper really tried to do is essentially, for the layman, we tried to look at, okay, what's the history of AI? Where did it come from? How has it developed? How can it be used in scientific research? What are the advantages and the disadvantages? You know, where are the challenges? And we just sort of tried to weigh the advantages and the challenges up as best as we could. And then what we decided to do was formulate recommendations both for users and possible policymakers for, you know, in our opinion, the ways that we could improve ethical use within the field. So we tried to come up with some recommendations together. And it was important to us to write it from a perspective that everyone would be able to understand it. So it was sort of, in that sense, like an overview commentary article. And I think we did a pretty good job at that.
Well, congratulations. I think it's a fine article. Why didn't we talk about what Can we define more precisely what the fundamental problem is here?
Well, there are several fundamental problems, but I'd say the fundamental problem that we were sort of looking at is scientific quality. So when you're using an AI, you know, it kind of goes into the authorship problem. So you have a lot of journals and you have a lot of academic institutions saying either it's fine to have an LLM as a co-author or it isn't. That's because of very differing opinions on whether it inhibits the scientific integrity of a work. So we were trying to look at, you know, the fact, does using ChatGPT, is what we used for this paper, to write things and as a co-author make the quality of the work worse? And we couldn't really find any concrete evidence of that in that sense, but there are definitely issues such as, you know, you've got possible privacy issues when you're inputting data. You've got possible issues with plagiarism. You've got possible issues with, you know, lack of creativity, the fact that we are less likely to, you know, instead of proofreading something four or five times because we've written it ourselves, only proofreading it once or twice. So you've kind of got the risk of relaxing people to the extent that their work might become sloppy. That was sort of the thing that we noticed could be an issue.
Yeah, in the sense that when people started to use, I don't know, oxes to pull plows, they probably got a bit weaker, right? And I kind of wonder whether, in the same kind of sense, the more, you know, I would imagine there is a degree to which we can overuse large language models and it makes us intellectually a bit weaker.
Yeah, I would agree. And that was sort of, you know, we tried to, in our recommendations, we tried to, I would say this overuse thing is exactly, you've hit the nail on the head. So when we were looking at our recommendations, for researchers, we really recommended, of course, obviously familiarizing yourself with the model as far as possible before using it, but really sort of limiting the use to creating first drafts, brainstorming an idea generation, and checking for errors in manuscripts. So we really sort of recommended not letting it do the bulk of the work. And I think, unfortunately, you're seeing a lot of people in academia begin to let ChatGPT or large language models do the bulk of the work. And in my opinion, in my team's opinion, that does run risk of, you know, sloppiness down the line.
Yeah, I mean, this is fascinating because I think that if you use a large language model, for example, to correct your grammar, nobody's going to add it to an author. Nobody's going to worry about that. But if you are getting a large language model to create your research program, the fundamental ideas tested in your research program, then on the one hand, it's certainly, that's quite a serious issue. It's very different. It's really worth looking at. But on the other hand, I can imagine that actually an LLM might come up with a better research program than a human. And I didn't know, what do you do with that? I don't really know.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting. I mean, I have this example in my real life. I mean, you're completely correct with grammar and spelling. I mean, my mum reads most of my articles before I send them off to a journal. And that's just because she's really good at correcting grammar. And I wouldn't list her as a co-author as much as I love her. But, you know, if you're looking at getting it to identify a topic or, you know, write a grant proposal or something, or, you know, really come up with something new. I had this recently where I was sort of debating because I was writing a paper and I wanted to combine several issues. I wanted to combine maternal and neonatal health, COVID-19 and the NHS. And so I inputted these three things into an LLM and I sort of said, can you come up with a research question that combines these three? And it did. And then I also asked, okay, can you give me the structure of the paper that you would write on this? And it did. And it was a brilliant structure. It's better than something that I could have come up with on the spot. And then you sort of get into tricky territory. You know, if I write the rest of the paper myself, would it still be, you know, could you still argue intellectual plagiarism because I took the idea technically from somewhere else? And that's definitely something that I have to talk to, you know, my team about and any professors that I work with, to what extent are we allowed to use it?
Now, you didn't list LLMs on your recent Journal of Medical AI paper.
No.
Were you tempted to in some sense? What were the criteria for choosing for the decision?
It was definitely discussed, actually, because we did actually, there are two places in the article where we have at least asked ChatGPT to give us an answer and we have used it in the article. But we sort of, what we did with that is we used those answers, we cited them as a quote, and we cited then ChatGPT as the author of that quote, but we didn't list it as a co-author because we didn't use it to write the actual substance of our paper. But there was debate within the team whether it might not actually make a really good point about what we're saying to list ChatGPT as an author, but we probably would have had to write it differently from the get-go to do that. But yeah, there was definitely that question at the beginning, and I think it would have been really interesting to do, actually.
So let's talk about, I think the benefits are fairly clear that you can, as we have said, you can use it for trivial things like grammar specs, grammar checking. You can also use it potentially to create research programs and research strategy, but that involves all these tricky issues. Now, let's talk about what the risks actually are then. Let's just say that the overuse of LLMs became completely endemic within medical research. What are the actual problems with that? What are the consequences?
Yeah, so I'd say there are sort of like a big three currently that I would look at, and that I've also sort of discovered even since writing the paper. So I'd say obviously the biggest issue that you have with something like ChatGPT, if you're using ChatGPT, is that AIs can hallucinate data and they can fake sources. I try to subvert that personally by using Google Bard, although it's obviously always recommended that you check whether those sources are legit and whether they actually fit what you're writing before going anywhere with it. So that's sort of the big one, is that you might be writing something that is not based on actual sources, and the data that it comes up with or the facts that it comes up with could be hallucinated by the model itself. That sort of comes from the black box problem and the fact that it can learn from itself, that at some point you're not sure where it's getting its information from, and it might actually turn out to not be entirely accurate. The second big issue is the risk of inadvertent plagiarism as someone using an LLM and writing. And so many people might think you might actually avoid this issue by listing it as a co-author, which I suppose to a certain extent you are. But I guess a big example right now would be, there is a big lawsuit from the New York Times against OpenAI, I believe, and Microsoft, because the texts that ChatGPT was trained on, or certain AI models were trained on, are actually copyright infringements, because they're not meant to be used for that purpose. And you'll see that a decent amount of texts, you can sort of find them again in articles that you look at from certain newspapers, so you can see where it's been trained. So you might, you know, if you might cite him as a source, or you might cite ChatGPT as a co-author, but you're not then citing the 20 different, you know, places where it actually got its training data from. And I'm not sure how many degrees of removal would be necessary to not need to do that. But it definitely can have legal implications if you are publishing something that is written mainly by ChatGPT. And then the third big issue that I think is possibly the biggest issue for me is that since it is trained on a certain amount of data and on itself, completely new ideas, so completely revolutionary ideas that have never been done before, are essentially undoable or impossible for an LLM currently. It can't come up with something that has not been something it's already seen or looked at to some extent. Everything is derivative to some extent, which I think that in the long run could definitely stunt innovation in research if we begin to rely on it too much. We'll stop coming up with completely new things ourselves.
Now, how do you think those problems or potential problems are problems with the current state of LLMs, as opposed to what LLMs might be in 10 years' time, when presumably there's been lots of improvements?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think really no one can predict where we're going to be with LLMs in the future. If you look at how quickly we've gotten to where we are with, for example, ChatGPT, you know, it first, you know, became available to the public, I think, on November 30th, 2022. Mm-hmm. So we've had just over a year of using it, and it's already been used in such varied ways. And it's already improved. You know, you've already seen us go from GPT-3 to 3.5 to GPT-4 in just the space of a couple of years. So I think in 10 years' time, these models could be so much more intelligent than we can even think of right now. I think there's no way to even fathom what they might be capable of. And at that point, they might be completely capable of, you know, removing any answers or texts that could have legal implications regarding copyright. They could be fully perfect at, you know, giving you legitimate sources. We're already seeing something like that with Google Bard. And they could actually, I mean, that's the real question. That's sort of the Turing question, isn't it? Could they come up with completely new ideas that they have never encountered before? I find that quite a scary thought, but I think it's a very interesting question to ask. And would it be bad? But at that point, you'd really have to ask the question of what distinguishes us from AI if it can come up with something that no one has taught it to do.
Yeah, well, they should stop awarding PhDs because nobody will be deserving of them anymore.
Yeah, I hope I'm through with mine at some point before that point.
All right, well, look, let's talk about the current state of the debate, because which I think is fascinating because... for one thing, it's so complex, right? We have the debate is populated by people who may not have any knowledge, technical knowledge about LLMs at all. Mm-hmm. Then you've got people who are fine medical researchers and use LLMs, but they're probably very hazy about how they work. And then you've got software developers. So in the last year, the debate on LLMs has obviously evolved very quickly. Could you just describe how that debate has evolved in the last year?
Yeah, well, so I can start from the point of medical researchers. I'm not a medical researcher in that sense, but I am a researcher in the medical field, I suppose. And I'd say that we've gone through a few stages. We've gone through complete and utter excitement about how this might revolutionize the way that we work, to, you know, apprehension. What does it mean for our scientific integrity? What does it mean for the quality? To, you know, sort of a bit of fear. Could this actually replace things that I'm doing to extents that I might not be needed anymore? And I think especially in the area of medical research, the debate is a little bit, I'd say, spicier in the sense that medical research is an area where people are very passionate and take huge pride in their work, in the sense that it has real life implications for people when things are published and things make progress. So I don't think most medical researchers are interested in churning out papers and research if it's without quality. So the debate is a little bit hotter in that area because people are worried about actually having real world implications for people's health. I think you're completely right that within the area of policy making, you've got a lot of people who don't know enough about AI when they're making policies. And I would argue, however, sort of to your earlier point, that not really anyone can have enough, not have that level of knowledge on AI when they're making policies. It's simply impossible because, first of all, we don't actually have the transparency of the models ourselves. So unless you're a developer, an A-star developer of AI who knows exactly what goes into these models, you're not going to be able to create perfect policy on it. And the issue with that is, even if we had someone like that, we would be at huge risk for them creating policies that are overly biased in favor of AI and possibly then even unsafe AI use.
Yeah.
So if we want the normal person who, you know, doesn't have sort of capitalist self-interest to keep AI running in that sense, then they will be uninformed. And so we see, for example, the European AI Act, which is moving in the direction of regulating LLMs. And, you know, lots of people think it's great, lots of people think it's terrible. But I think another really big issue is, as you say, the accelerated pace at which this has been happening is so huge. You know, the AI Act was sort of being worked on in April 2023. By the time it's actually gone through the European Parliament and it's been, you know, made into law, we might be several models further and several versions further with AI, and it might be capable of doing stuff that's not in the regulation at all. So, you know, I think it's sort of like a textbook. As soon as you buy it, as soon as it's been published and put on the shelf, it's already outdated. So I think that in that sense, policy is also quite risky because it will be inherently outdated as soon as it's been passed.
Okay, so we know that the policy is evolving probably slowly and imperfectly within bodies like the MHRA and in the EU as well, and the FDA. How is it being treated in the philosophical world?
Well, that's an interesting question. I think that, you know, I'm not a philosopher myself, even though I find them very interesting. But I do think the philosophers tend to more focus, don't they, on the, you know, the human question of AI. And, you know, the philosophy has all come all the way from Turing, really, and even ancient philosophers, sort of looking at, you know, what makes a person and what makes things that aren't human, non-human. And so I think they're kind of more looking at that fundamental question when it comes to AI. I wouldn't say that they're driving policy, and I wouldn't even say that they are massively involved in the debate of what we should and shouldn't be doing with it. I think they're asking very much more fundamental questions, which I think are really important as well for other people to move the debate along. Because it definitely does make me wonder, you know, at some point, what actually does separate us. And so I think they're asking sort of that more fundamental question, which is very interesting to read and sometimes a bit scary to read about.
Now, just in terms of publishing medical science articles in the academic literature, what are the ground rules there and who are they being set by?
Well, that's a very good question, because as we found out in our article, there aren't really any ground rules that are broad scope. You have very, you know, you have single journals that say certain things. So, for example, you know, Nature or Springer Nature journals say we're not allowed to have them as authors and research papers. But you do have other journals that either haven't got any policy on it yet or say that it's okay under certain conditions. So, you know, you've gotten to a point where you really need to decide before you want to publish somewhere, you know, where you want to publish it and have a look at their AI policy. And so that was sort of what we were, that was one of the core problems that we discovered in the article, is that there is no broad scope policy, at least in the academic field or in the scientific journalism field. And I think it'll be difficult to do, because I think that there are, the opinions are so far ranging on it. On the other hand, I do think that a lot of journals will probably, as we've seen with Nature and Springer Nature, tend towards rejecting the idea of large use of AI in their papers, which I wouldn't say is the right answer either, because it can be used so effectively and so well in journal writing. So yeah, it's a bit difficult. It's a bit difficult. And I'm not sure we'll ever really get everyone on the same page.
And okay, I've saved the most difficult question for the last, because how do you, and you've already said, in fairness, that this, the direction of travel in this debate is extremely unpredictable. But if somebody held a gun to your head, which hopefully they won't, and forced you to predict how this is going to move within the next, say, 10 years, I mean, what would you say about that?
Well, I'd start off by saying that the condition for that is that it, you know, the small amount of people, it is a relatively small amount of people who are in that high level AI, LLM development, they need to stay the same. You know, you saw it with Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, when he was fired and then, you know, rehired a week later because nothing worked without him. If God forbid, you know, a tsunami wiped out the OpenAI office and all the people in it, then that would make the question very different, because it relies, the future of AI relies on a very small group of people. But should everything stay the way it is, I think what we'll definitely see is it will move more out of the public realm, in the sense that I think it will be highly monetized and it will become a commodity to be bought and a luxury to be to use, as we see with almost any technology that can be used for the greater good. It eventually you know, does fall victim to capitalism. But I do think that it will become usable and perfect to the extent that you could, for example, ask it to write your full PhD for you, and you could completely trust in the fact that the citations and the sources and the structure would be perfect, and that you could even rely on it to come up with a completely innovative idea, so it would be an original work. So I think we'll definitely see a lot of people possibly becoming qualified or even publishing in journals who maybe, you know, at this point in time wouldn't be able to do so. And I think the current trend of, you know, there's a huge increase in publication of scientific articles that we've seen last year, which might be due to LLMs, that's definitely going to rise, in my opinion. So Yeah, I think it's definitely unpredictable, but I think we can definitely predict that it's going to get much more intelligent, much better to use. It can do much more things more accurately, and that we're probably going to have to pay to use it a lot more in the future.
All right, look, Fiona, last question, and that is, ignoring your own particular field, what AI system would you pick out as your personal favorite out of everything?
Well, yeah, okay. I was actually quite excited. I think this question is really exciting because I recently read about an AI application in the medical field that some people have been working on, which is an AI that can look at retinal images or images of the optical nerve and diagnose with almost 100% accuracy, or currently, it's a small control group with 100% accuracy can diagnose autism. And I think that's really, really interesting because I had no idea, first of all, that there are differences in the retina there. And I think it's absolutely incredible that a technology has been developed that can,
yes,
you know, make the tens of psychiatrist visits that you make before being diagnosed with autism completely obsolete by just having, you know, a quick look at the optical nerve and being able, yeah, to say yes or no. So I think that's really cool.
That is absolutely fascinating. And I love these systems where what you'd think is just complete junk data can actually turn out to be very, very informative. Yeah. It's fascinating, yes. Well, that's a very nice note to end on. Look, Fiona, thank you so much for joining. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I think you've given a really great, very lucid account of this area. It's very, very interesting. So thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It was lovely to talk to you.
Great. Thank you for listening. This has been the Medical AI Podcast. We are Felix Beecher and Joe McKeating. Ping us on LinkedIn if you have any ideas on new guests. See you next time.